Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today, nearly live from Ottawa, Ontario. Great episode for you today, because if you have ever been on the internet, which you have been if you're listening to this as the show is released through the internet, you have undoubtedly come across some material that intentionally distorts the truth for various aims. And this week we're talking about how we can navigate online spaces and come to a point where we are better able to discern between fact and fiction, between good actors and bad actors in terms of content creators on the internet. And I was very excited to talk with Bethany Kilcrease, who's a professor of history at Aquinas College in Michigan, who has written a new book entitled Falsehood and Fallacy, How to Think, Read, and Write in the 21st Century. And the book very much focuses on those two principal terms of falsehood and fallacy. And it does focus on student reaction and student engagement at the college level with online material, how to teach people about navigating internet spaces. But it's a lot broader than just an educational setting. There's material in there for all of us that we could all benefit from in assessing online sources, things like the CRAAP test, for instance, CRAAP being an acronym. And we talk about that on the show. And of course, given everything that's gone on the past couple of years, these issues have just increased in prominence. Certainly, they've been around for a long time. They're not new, but they're getting a lot more attention here in 2022 than they did certainly 5 to 10 years ago. So very excited to have this conversation. Hopefully you enjoy it. And at the end, when I ask Bethany, do you have tips for folks? A lot of great material in there. So I learned a lot from this, things that certainly I can incorporate in my own online research and just in reading things as you go through your day. And hopefully you have that same reaction. So let's get right into my discussion with Bethany Kilcrease. Okay, and Bethany Kilcrease joins me now from her office in Aquinas College. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. I'm very excited to talk to you. Again, the book entitled Falsehood and Fallacy, How to Think, Read, and Write in the 21st Century. A lot to unpack in this book, but let's start with just the core premise of the book of falsehoods and fallacies. And how do you define these two things? Because so much of what gets presented now as news is really, to me, comes across as opinion. And so how do you navigate the line of outward and direct falsehoods and fallacies as opposed to certain opinion pieces that a lot of folks might disagree with?
Yeah, that's a really good point and a really good question. And so one thing I think that's important to get down, and this is something that I talk with my students in my 100-level history classes about, is how do we talk about an opinion versus an interpretation, and what's the difference? How does that relate to, like you say, falsehood or things being true? And one way I like to put this is, you know, when we think about what's an opinion, you know, today everybody tosses out, you know, I don't like what you're saying. That's just your opinion. You know, I got an opinion too. So, but opinion, that's, you know, a belief in the absence of fact or evidence. Whereas as historians, I'm an historian. I mean, I hope people who aren't historians read the book and buy it and all that good stuff too. But yeah, but when we look at an interpretation, we're making historical interpretations or arguments. That's an argument made on the basis of some kind of evidence, right? And yeah, in that case, we want to be able to figure out what sources we're using.
Right. And so one of the examples that somebody who I follow often uses about opinion versus fact, they say, well, everyone, yes, has an opinion, but the validity of that opinion will depend. Like, my opinion could be that the moon is made out of blue cheese, but like, so that could be an opinion I have, but of course it's not based on anything, right? or yeah, whatever you want it to be, whatever type of cheese you want. So it really comes to the idea of what is that based on? And one of the things that I've thought, though, and I thought about reading the book, is that with academics and academic books, you have footnotes and people can, in theory, go and check up on where that information comes from. But in the 21st century, a tweet, lots of news articles, they don't have that. So is the crux of it essentially a sense of accountability in how we navigate that space and the space between falsehood, fallacy, and opinion?
Yeah, I think that's important. I mean, one thing about footnotes and books, just to kind of go back to that, maybe that's interesting. You know, I think increasingly in a lot of books that you might see, it's sort of in the space between super scholarly monographs and maybe more very popular books. Increasingly, you're seeing fewer footnotes and endnotes. And part of that seems to be that publishers don't want to scare people. Right? So people, you know, the buying public looks at that and they're just like, whoa, I don't, you know, there's this scholarly apparatus I don't want to mess with. So they're either getting bumped to endnotes or there's increasing pressure to just cut down on those altogether. So we do have that going on. But regarding, you know, the scholarly apparatus, footnoting things, you know, what's the point of that? I think it was, don't quote me, I think it was maybe Stanley Fish who said something like this. But he wrote somewhere that really the point of this, and we're looking at, you know, sources and citations and footnotes and all of this, it's not to play some kind of a gotcha game, because I think it feels like sometimes, you know, the whole point of this is just to say gotcha, you know, and if you have a tweet or a post or something and, you know, students can't cite it or whatever, well, it's just a gotcha thing on the part of the teacher, the professor, or this person you're talking with, you know, that you can't put it back. But really it's a matter of being able to sort of trace your footsteps back to the source, right? So it's leaving a crumb trail is what it's doing, so that way anybody in the public can go out and follow the crumb trail back, right, to the source, to the source of the spring, so to speak.
Right. It's almost like the humanities equivalent of, in science, they talk about being able to replicate the experiment.
100%.
Right. So it's the same idea that, yeah, anybody in the public, in theory, can go and just find out where this information is coming from. And therefore, it makes it so that it's not you doing it. You might have been the one to have found it somewhere, but you're sharing where you found it with anybody else. So it's a nod to transparency in the research, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Carl Truman has a book that I mentioned in this book and that I've used in my historiography class, where he, you know, makes a distinction between bias versus objectivity, right? Because a lot of times people will say you can't be objective in history or the humanities or the social sciences because we all have a bias, right? And, you know, yeah, that's true. I mean, we're all biased. We all have our own subjectivity that we can't escape to a degree. And Truman says, yeah, that's right. You know, we're all biased. And so it's true that nobody can be neutral. But does that mean that we can't be objective? Well, no, in the sense that we are able to, through the use of, like you say, a scholarly apparatus like footnotes and citations, be able to leave these peanut trails or these crumb trails, right, that make things reproducible like you would see in the sciences, right, where they get to follow a scientific method and reproduce the experiment so that the public can then go back and see, oh, does this interpretation jive with the evidence or does it not?
Now, one of the problems, though, again, 21st century, is that so much of digital publishing doesn't allow for that, or it links to bad things. And again, the book makes reference to examples of websites that are intentionally false, satirical websites, that those stories get picked up on as fact, and they sort of spiral out of control within the digital environment. And so without the footnoting and the apparatus that is available in a scholarly setting, that there's this wildfire to it. And the book also talks about students and really focuses on how students navigate this space, because students today, college students, will have grown up entirely with the internet, where I remember the first time that it was presented to me, I think it was in grade 6 or 7, there was a computer lab, everybody was very excited. The idea of email was brand new. So looking at the way in which current students look at these issues, it strikes me that somebody like me might be less well equipped than a current student to actually navigate the online environment and this space where so much fallacy and falsehoods can be presented and can be presented as facts. So when we're talking about current students, what approach did you use to assess that? And is my assumption correct that modern day students are entering into a college space really well prepared to navigate this stuff?
I think that's a really common assumption that teachers and instructors going up to college faculty make is that, you know, oh, these youngins these days, you know, they're on the Instagram and whatever, so they're really well equipped to discern what they find out there on the wild web and all this. But unfortunately, we know from some pretty good research that's been done by people like Sam Weinberg and the Chegg group that this just isn't the case, right? They've done a lot of research looking at thousands of middle school, high school, and college age students, testing their ability to, for example, discern even things that might on the surface seem as simple as advertisements versus non-advertisements on the web. And what they discovered was that, I think the actual quote that Weinberg had is that the results were dismal. Don't quote me on his quote, but that they were not very optimistic in the sense that what you might think is that they have this great ability to discern what they find on the web, but not necessarily. And what I've discovered is that students, generally speaking, have a sense that there's some kind of a filter in Google whereby there's some kind of an algorithm in there that it will filter up the most true or accurate pages to the top, and that is just not true. That is absolutely right. Not how Google's algorithms work. And yet there's this sort of urban legend about it. So I think the idea that students come into the classroom today equipped to navigate the web and discern, you know, what is the most authoritative, relevant, accurate information is just not true. Now, they are very savvy when it comes to things, perhaps like texting, some social media use. You know, I'm sure they're way more savvy than me. I don't even have an Instagram account. So I guarantee you they're more savvy than me when it comes to that. But on the other hand, I think the assumption that they are automatically savvy at everything and able to discern things on the internet in terms of authenticity, accuracy, has meant that maybe instructors from the high school level up into college haven't actually taught these skills in the classroom.
And how much of that is potentially related to, one, the instructors themselves might not be overly familiar with how to navigate these spaces? I mean, I have a sense of what is accurate, what's not, but within the context of, say, we were talking before, the protest in Ottawa, on Twitter and stuff, you'd see links, people linking to articles from certain sources that and outlets that I had never heard of. And I'm wondering, like, how is this just a new outlet, or is this not accurate? And so it was kind of difficult for me to navigate that in real time because there was so much of it.
Right.
While at the same time, we were all 18 at some point, and 18 and 20 years old, and we knew everything in the world that needed to be known. We were experts in everything.
Really?
We were flying high on top of the world. So how much of it too is just the idea of the combination of instructors not necessarily knowing how to navigate the space themselves and therefore not being able to teach it, while at the same time that late teenage, early 20 mentality of I can do it myself. I'm an expert. I know everything.
Yeah, you know, I don't know that there's so much of a mentality of I know everything, I can do, you know, like we're talking about earlier, again, we're talking about students coming in and saying that they don't know how to write.
Right.
You know, when they actually do.
Yeah.
You know, I think in my experience, and again, I didn't, for the book, I didn't look at secondary sources related to this particular question or do any kind of study on it, but my just anecdotal sense is that students coming in don't really have a much confidence in their ability to conduct research either online or via what we might think of as more traditional sources or the stacks, so to speak, or things like that. They, you know, I think are waiting for instruction. And I think, you know, professors and faculty, high school teachers are able to give that, but there are some gaps. And I think that the COVID-19 pandemic crisis has definitely revealed some of that when it was time. And we unfortunately had to pivot to all virtual instruction. I'm not sure quite how long that lasted in Canada, but at different lengths of times, depending on the location. In America, some places might still be virtual. Where I teach, we did a semester virtual, and then we did sort of a hybrid approach, some classes being all virtual, some in person, some high flex. And what that did reveal is that for a lot of us, I mean, myself included, right, had some catching up to do when it came to just the technological stuff. And that meant also looking at a lot more stuff on the web, because students weren't able to actually get out to libraries and things like this, right? You have to do all of your research for assignments, research papers from home, if you're in isolation, on the web. And that means, well, we're going to have to actually look at some of these maybe new sites, sources that they're looking at, and make sure that they're going to be okay in some sense to use. So I think that has made faculty look a little bit more closely at some of the online sources just out of necessity when students can't physically go to a library.
Well, I've noticed over the last 10 years, so the first time I taught a university level course was 2011, I think. So about 10 years that I've been teaching here and there courses.
2009.
Okay. So we're about starting about the same time. So maybe you've noticed this as well. I'd be curious to get your thoughts on it, that when I started, it was pretty common for books to be cited in essays and assignments. I find that now it's definitely decreased, and it's a lot more online and a lot more online articles. They're pretty good with students tend to be pretty good with the online databases, JSTOR, EBSCO, whatever it is. But the percentage of books being cited is way down. So it feels to me like COVID and the closure of libraries may have just push that trend even further, that you can't get a copy of the hardcover book. But maybe at the same time too, certainly in the two institutions that I'm mildly involved with here in Ottawa, I feel like from when I was doing my comps 15 years ago or whenever it was, there's way more online books too, right? So you can go into those resources and have them. So I'm curious, like how much of the investment into quality databases for good material has maybe offset the shift of students towards preferring online material?
Big topic there. Yeah, I think you're definitely right. Just thinking back, definitely when I started, students were still citing books. I mean, physical books, okay? And they went to the library and they would even pull actual journals, print journals, okay, out of the stacks and cite things like this. And that's definitely declined. And obviously with the COVID pandemic just collapsed altogether. But like you say, we do have research telling us that this predates the pandemic in terms of what sources students look at. I've been looking primarily at online sources for a while. And, you know, let's be honest, that I think seems maybe easier, but I don't want to make it seem like it's just easier in the sense that students are lazy. I don't think that's it. I mean, I think it actually also seems better in the sense that there's just more available. And so why wouldn't you, you know, go to the restaurant that has the buffet as opposed to the place that's got like just the one option, right?
Right.
So there's a logic to that, I think. So yes, I think, you know, I've seen this too, that there's been a real dearth of that. Now, one thing I have not seen, which is, I guess, interesting compared to you, is students coming in with knowledge of JSTOR or, you know, Project Muse or ProQuest or other types of databases. So that's something that, at least here, we've really had to teach and teach the difference between looking at an online sort of peer-reviewed published article on a database versus maybe a blog post, that there's a difference there. And so that's not something, in my experience, that students coming in are going to automatically see, that there's a distinction between a tweet, a blog post, a newspaper, an online newspaper article, an online magazine, an academic article in a database, or an open source, you know, article that's also peer reviewed, what peer review is, etc. Yeah. So that's, I think, a learning curve for a lot of students still.
Yeah. And the other thing too is so many of the, I guess I'll call them the predatory journals too, that exist, that students can get caught up in sometimes too, of the, those ones that aren't peer reviewed that just churn out stuff, but they have fancy sounding names that you can kind of get caught up in there too. So it really is, you know, dependent on all of us to try to teach and direct people towards the real quality journals. And I think this is where so many of my library friends are probably listening to this being like, just tell them to talk to us. Like, we know. Like,
yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know. Yeah. No, seriously. I mean, yeah. I mean, this should be in so many classes, right? You know, the librarian is the historian's best friend. I mean, we need to be doing a better job of working with information technology specialists and saying, go talk to a librarian, please. When you are looking for sources, they will help you, get you a roadmap, get you in the right place. I know I personally need to do a better job bringing librarians into my classroom, right, to actually get them in there and working with students. I think we can definitely do a much better job integrating professional librarians and other information technology specialists into our teaching and working with students.
Now, that does lead to the question, though, about gatekeeping. And again, one of the things that comes up in the book is the idea that 40 years ago, the number of gatekeepers of information was relatively small, certainly comparably small to today, that you had a certain level of confidence in a lot of the information that was put forth because there were gatekeepers and people who would ensure that quality stuff would come out. And even when there was a mistake, I mean, the corrections page is a staple of newspapers because sometimes bad stuff gets through, but it gets corrected. That's the whole point of the corrections page. But now the gatekeepers are fewer and fewer, and the legitimacy or authority of those gatekeepers has been compromised, intentionally compromised by some who attack them for a certain political purpose. But you mentioned earlier the idea that students trust Google as filtering quality information to the top, which we know isn't true. Same thing with a Twitter algorithm, that it's not really pushing, or at Facebook, they're not pushing the best information. They're pushing stuff that gets engagement. So the idea of who is actually governing, who is gatekeeping the information, it's not really there. Now, I think there's pros to that, but there's also a lot of cons to that. So how do you try to assess the state of gatekeeping and how it has really influenced the way in which people find and assess information?
Yeah, thanks. I guess one thing I'd like to say that I wish I would have brought out more in the book, and nobody since it was published has really said anything to me about this, but just in retrospect, thinking about it, I think it's worth making the point a little bit more strongly than I did in the book, well, maybe a lot more strongly than I did in the book, that gatekeeping is not always a good thing, okay? That there are definitely, there's structural problems with gatekeeping. I mean, that gatekeeping in the sense of, you know, a quote-unquote mainstream media that, and, you know, college faculties, you know, have historically been populated and controlled by a certain segment of the population in terms of, you know, race, class, gender. And this is going to have the effect structurally of keeping out minority voices or oppressed voices. So I think it is important to bear that in mind. Okay, so there are definitely structural pitfalls to gatekeeping, so to speak. So one really good thing about the gates coming down is that more voices are getting out there. So that's a good thing. Also, I think it's probably worth saying, and this I did not address at all in the book, but maybe I should have. If you're coming from it from maybe another perspective today, and I do have friends today who would say, the mainstream media, the MSM, right? You know, can we trust them? I don't know. Well, maybe, yeah, usually, but not always, right? I mean, because again, there's going to be blind spots whenever you have any institution. So that's why hopefully we have, you know, investigative journalists who are upholding high standards and independent investigative journalists. So yeah, gatekeeping, not 100% good, just to clarify that. But on the other hand, there's definitely some benefits to that, right? Is that, like you say, you do have professionals who are trained in journalistic standards, for example, university professors who are trained in their disciplines, peer review for various academic monographs and journals who are out there sifting through for errors, who are then publishing errata or, you know, corrections pages, things like this. That did make it a little bit easier. It used to be the case that even when I started teaching, I guess when I was doing a senior seminar and I wanted to give students, you know, let's look at some primary sources on something, give them a physical collection of a primary source reader that's been vetted by professionals in the field and put it up there. And these days, more often students are going online for primary sources, which fine, but again, you need to be a little bit more careful and think about different types of internal, external criticism on those sources before you just would dive into those.
Right. Right. So the book does talk about the CRAAP test, the C-R-A-A-P test. So what is that for people who haven't come across it before? And how do you explain that to students?
Yeah. Okay. The CRAAP test. So that's been around for a long time. I did not come up with that witty acronym. It's been around for a while. I think some librarians out in California came up with that initially. But and there's actually one of the anonymous peer reviewers of the book was like, I don't like that. That's really old fashioned. You can't apply it. And it's like, well, can't apply that to the internet. And, oh, I think it does apply to the internet. I think that's not just for physical books. I think that this is still relevant. I guess no pun intended, because one of the things is relevant. So, okay, it's CRAAP, but with two A's. So it's like for app, maybe. But that would be C, you know, currencies. Look at the currency of your sources. This is a big one for students, especially when it comes to physical books, actually, I find. Because oftentimes, university libraries have put a lot of the resources, like you were saying, into expensive online databases. And so there's been, in some cases, less left over for physical books. And so there might actually be older books on the shelves, which is not necessarily the best scholarship, which might actually be in an ebook you could have access to via your library, which is more current. So, you know, just because it's physical doesn't mean it's better necessarily either. Anyway, currency. Then R, relevance. Is it actually relevant to your topic? So I mean, if it's tangential, then it's probably not. Authority, right? So who's writing it? What are their credentials? So this is a one that has come up a lot, I think, with the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. So what's the authority of the person you're taking information from? This also come up with other recent, seems like we're living through crisis after crisis. World historical crises never seem to have ended the past couple of years, but they just keep coming up. So check the authority of the individual you're looking at. If you're looking at a meme online or something, right, check, so you can check back. Who is this person? What are their credentials that they're saying? When it comes to things like infectious diseases, you know, does the person have, are they a doctor of what, of literature? That's probably not going to be, you know, the best doctorate even. And I don't want to sound like I am in any sense putting down general practitioners, but someone who's an MD or a DO and a general practitioner is also not going to have the type of specialized knowledge that someone working more specifically in that field in a research position would have. So there's different levels of authority too. And then A, accuracy, obviously, is an accurate piece, and there's different ways you can work with that. And then purpose. What's the purpose of it? So you want to be thinking about the bias, the context. Is it an advertisement? Are they trying to sell you Pepsi or something? Then probably don't use it as a source in a paper on how good Pepsi tastes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's something I talk to students about all the time, is try to understand that purpose. Why is something being created? What is the reason for it? And what is the person who's creating it trying to accomplish by doing it? That's something that so often gets forgotten, I think, is that last part of it is they'll often say, well, it's in a book, it's in an article, like it's obviously good. But why is it there, right? There's a reason why it's there, even if sometimes it might be unconscious by the person creating it. It's there for a reason. I always remember I had a professor as an undergraduate. He showed me his book. It had just come out. And he said, I remember getting into screaming matches with the editors about something they wanted me to cut. And we cut it, and I don't even remember what it is at this point. And I thought, well, that's an interesting example of, obviously he wanted it there for a reason, but it didn't matter. So, if it had been there, it was there for a reason, and he put mm-hmm. it there, and it was important to him at the time for some purpose. So it tends to be something that gets overlooked by students, and it's obvious on an advertisement, maybe less obvious in some other forms of media though.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, just to give you one example that I can think of from, I'll do one from a few years ago, but this was in a seminar class. Student was doing a research paper on the British Palestinian mandate and the partition and all of this, and had this source and thought it was a really good secondary source. And I said, well, let's dig a little bit deeper into this source that you found. Where's this come from? And so took a look at the site, and let's look at the organization. What is this? And it turned out to be a Palestinian liberation organization, which, that's not to say that there's not definitely facts in this, right? But yep. It is to say we need to make sure we're keeping the possible, purpose for which it's written, which is to persuade, in this case, it was to persuade the reader of a certain perspective on the British mandate and the history of Palestine after World War I. Mm-hmm. So we want to keep that in mind along with any possible biases.
And one of the things that has come up recently in terms of like biases and purpose and the quality of information, both with the pandemic and what's going on currently in Ukraine, is the idea of short form pieces of information, in particular TikTok. There have been a lot of infectious disease experts who have effectively, I think, communicated via TikTok in short form. Of course, there's been people who are not infectious disease experts who have been communicating about COVID on TikTok as well. I know in the United States, the White House has been getting a certain amount of criticism for inviting TikTok influencers to talk about Ukraine, right, and the influence of that. But it also gets back to what we talked about before we started to record it, and you mentioned earlier, that the idea that students think they can't write, but they write a lot. And it strikes me that when things like TikTok or Instagram or Twitter or whatever else is out there, Reddit, that the quality of writing is going to fit those mediums. And the way in which students write is different from the way I was taught to write as an undergraduate, because it's a lot shorter form, even shorter than, I was taught to write in newspaper formats. We're talking even much shorter than newspaper formats. So when we talk about the quality of writing, quality of information, how can we assess that against the media for which it is created? And how can we try to impart to students that you know how to write for these things, because the majority of them do it every day, and therefore you also inherently have the tool to assess quality writing within those various platforms?
Good thing to talk about. I just want to give a shout out actually to my colleague here, Dr. Gretchen Rumer. And when I started working here, she's the one who was really like, she runs our freshman sort of rec comp program, was really like, yeah, they do know how to write, they just don't know it. So, I mean, that's by no means an original thought to me necessarily. But, I would say, it's true that we're going to a lot more short form writing, and students do have experience in this. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, I'll come back to the sort of quote-unquote academic writing in a second, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think we were talking about maybe before we started doing radio shows and writing for that. So I do teach a World War I class, and one of the things that we do is we make a class podcast show in that class. And so one of the assignments, you know, they each have to do episodes, and they have to write scripts for the episodes. So it's, like you say, it's a short form. They're just supposed to be maybe between 2 and 5 minute little hot take episodes on something interesting about an aspect of World War I. So they're very short scripts, but that's different. And, you know, I don't think that that's a bad thing for teachers, instructors to encourage that, because like you say, a lot of information is being imparted via shorter forms these days. I mean, people have called this the TikTok war, right? In Ukraine and Russia, with the use of the TikTok to spread information and all of this. So that's not, I think, wrong. We just need to make sure that we're distinguishing among genres. Okay. So the way that you would write to do a script for maybe a 2-5 minute podcast, and that's just meant to kind of be an interesting topic for people on World War I, get them interested. It's going to be different than how you're going to write if you're doing some type of academic history paper that you're looking to publish in maybe an undergrad journal or do a presentation on or something like this, right? Even as, you know, professional scholars, we write differently for different occasions and genres, right? So I write differently if I'm doing a paper for a conference or a talk I'm giving than I do if I'm going to publish in an article. So same thing. There's different expectations, and I think it's just a matter of teaching around those expectations. And I think that when students realize that they can write, they're already, you know, they're always texting. I know they're always looking down at their lap and laughing in class, right? And I know you're texting down there. So if the, you know, if they know, you know, you're writing, you can do the thing. It's just a matter of learning some of the conventions around different genres that you might not know yet. And that's okay. Right. I mean, like maybe, you know, in terms for, you know, athletes, they, you know, probably know the basics of various ball games, right? Like an American might know baseball and have the basics of that down. Well, you could probably play cricket. You would just need to have somebody, you know, teach you about, you know, wickets and this type of thing. So you can learn the different rules, so to speak.
Yeah, and another thing that comes to mind too is the idea of consumption. And the advice I've always been given is if you want to learn how to write, read, and read other people, right? Right. So it's the same thing though. Like if you want to write academic stuff, read academic stuff and good academic stuff, which not all of it's good, but you know, read the good stuff. If you want to learn how to read or write fantasy stories, read fantasy stories. If you want to learn how to effectively do a TikTok video, you're going to have to watch a lot of TikTok videos. And it really is. And part of that too is then learning how to consume the good stuff or where to find the good stuff in each platform, within each form of media. And it's really that consumption side of it. And I wonder if students, or just in general, people are conscious of that, that you need to have a lot of that consumption in order to be able to produce yourself. And for students, is that something that comes up with them that they don't necessarily realize or articulate, that as they consume texts from their friends or tweets or Instagram posts or whatever it is, that they are actually learning how to create and write for those media?
Yeah, I don't think that's an obvious link for folks. So I think, you know, that I at least do try to be explicit about that. You know, like if you want to, one of the biggest criticisms I get on my student evals at the end of the semester is, professor makes us read a lot. Okay, well, true, that's accurate. but if you want to be able to write well and communicate well, you're going to have to, again, consume, like you put it, a lot of this content. And that goes for just writing, period, in any genre. You have to, you know, be able to flex your muscles, right? I mean, so a lot of our students are athletes here, and I think that students in general, oftentimes, you know, they played sports in high school or, you know, elementary school or in clubs. And so they understand the language, which is that, you know, you have to train and build up muscles and, you know, muscle memory for things when you're going to play a sport and get better at it. And that's the exact same way when it comes to reading and writing. I mean, the reading is the kind of conditioning that you're going to do. Like, you're in the gym, you're going to lift weights, you're going to do that kind of stuff, right? You got to have conditioning before you're going to be able to go out and then actually get on the ball field, the diamond, or you're going to actually go out and run a cross country invitational or something like that. So same thing, you know, you got to keep building those muscles, right? And that goes for, you know, different, even writing assignments that they might not like too so much. Right? So when I teach historiography, they have to do, write abstracts of different authors. And I say, look, you know, this is like in cross country. These are like half mile repeats, right? Going uphill, they're not fun, but you got to keep doing them because it's going to burn your quads, man. But, you know, it's going to build your muscles up and you're going to be able to read better and you're going to be able to write more effectively if you just keep working at these. And it's going to pay off.
Yeah. And like with going to the gym and training physically, it gets easier too, the more you do it, right? And you build that muscle memory.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I should have added that part. Yeah, it gets easier, right? I mean, if you're a little out of shape to start with, you know, don't worry, you know, jump in, start small, but it's gonna get easier and you're gonna get stronger and everybody can do it, right? Everybody's a reader, everybody's a writer. It's just we all have to keep together building up those muscles and then using them. Because right? If you don't use them, they're gonna atrophy, just like anything else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now there's so much to talk about in this book. And I want to talk about one more thing before we sign off. And I would certainly encourage everybody to check out the book because there's a lot more than we could possibly get to in the time that we have today. But I want to talk about causation because the book goes into causation and one of the main issues of causation. And it comes up all the time in ridiculous forms. Like, I've never been hit by a car. I wear shoes all the time. Therefore, the shoes are protecting me from cars. Like, that's clearly a connection, right? And obviously that's ludicrous, but people make connections all the time and that have no causation. And the situation in Ukraine, I would say, is one such situation where everybody is blaming the war on certain causes that from afar, I look at them and I say, this has, from my understanding, nothing to do with why why Russia has decided to invade Ukraine. So how do you try to approach the issues of causation? And what is your assessment in general of how students, and maybe even just the public at large, try to determine how can they navigate whether or not the causation that's being presented to them has any basis in reality?
Okay. Yeah, I think this is a really important issue. Again, I'm thinking as a historian here, causation is obviously one of the big things that we think about as historians, but it's important for everybody to think about, like you mentioned, with the Russo-Ukrainian war that's going on right now. Like I was saying earlier, I wish I would have written this prior to some of these events, so I could have talked about that. But the first big thing that I think you were sort of hinting at with the shoe example is that there's a difference between correlation and causation. And this comes up a lot with students in oftentimes, you know, tests and papers that, well, these things happened around the same time. And so therefore, or one happened prior to the other. And so therefore, this must have caused the other. Well, not necessarily. And, you know, this is one of those things that if you Google it, of course, careful what you're Googling, but if you Google it, you can get all kinds of humorous charts, you know, that'll show you the incidence of like shark bites related to orange juice consumption. You know, I'm just making that up, but they'll show you how the graphs like perfectly align with each other. It's like clearly shark bites cause orange juice consumption. Well, no, that's not the case. So that's one thing. But I also think a lot of, maybe not a ton, but some issues that we debate in the U.S. at least, and Canada, I'm sure too, there's talking past each other because we're talking about causation differently. So one group could be talking about, I think one of the examples I get in here, it's unfortunately, probably more pertinent in the U.S. is with school shootings, right? So one group might say, well, it's because of the fact that there's guns available of a certain type you can easily purchase. Someone else might say, no, it's because this individual on that day was bullied in some way. And so, you know, well, they could both be true, actually, but we're looking at different things, right? So we can talk about different types of causes. Right. We can talk about there being necessary causes, there being direct agent causes, there being causes that will just make things more likely than not. So we can look at things differently. The example I always get is the one that kind of comes from Mark Bloch, which involves, I always do it where I say, like, I'm falling off a mountain. And then the students are always like, oh my gosh, did you really fall off the mountain? And I'm like, no, why would I do that? But where you're climbing up the mountain and you're hiking on the mountain. And then I trip and I fall off the mountain. I say, and I like break my arm or something, and they get all worried about me, but it's fine. And I say, okay, so what caused that to happen? Right. And well, you tripped or something. Okay. But what about the mountain, right? If the mountain had been there, I would have just tripped and nothing would have happened, right? I wouldn't have broke my arm. Well, the mountain, you know, that's got to be there. So that's a necessary cause. It's necessary for the mountain to be there for me to have done that. And yet, did the mountain itself actually directly, was a direct agent causing me to break my arm? No, that was me tripping, right? So that's right. More direct. But also, I could be just a clumsy person, which might increase the probability. Right. So there's all these different ways we can talk about it.
Right. Or it rained that day. And so it was slippery. Yeah, and, exactly. You know, like, that's a cause, right? Yeah. So and rarely in life, and when we're talking about complex issues, is there a singular cause to something. When we're talking about these really just broad issues that when you're talking about Ukraine, for instance, like, I mean, certain, right, the singular cause to it is a lot harder than slipping on a mountain, maybe. But the point does hold really well that it's really hard to assess a singular cause to really anything. But that is so much of what the media environment is today. It's the blame game about causation. And you mentioned talking past each other. That's really what happens. That I felt like that was a lot of what happened with the protests here in Ottawa that I lived through. I feel like that's a lot of what COVID has been to a certain extent, just talking past each other on the issue of causation. And I don't know, it almost strikes me as in some cases, the cause of something doesn't necessarily matter as much as we make it out to matter. Like something exists and we might have to resolve it. The cause doesn't strike me as always the most important part of it. And yet it takes the cause or causation takes really the most prominent place in the discussion a lot of times. And does that lead to some of what you found in terms of the fallacies about any sort of issue, is that we're focusing maybe on the wrong thing?
Right. That's a fallacy right there. I mean, mono causation, right? Nothing is a single cause. You know, why do we do that? It's easy. It's easier. And it's more, and there's been a lot of good work written on this. It's just more emotionally satisfying in a way. And this is where scapegoating, another fallacy, comes from, which gets us into conspiracy theories, right? Which we can talk about. We talk about related to COVID or related to any number of things, right? That when you look at the real world and the past and the present, and you see, oh my gosh, there's all these causes of things. It's really complicated, right? Life is really messy, okay? And that it can be overwhelming because it just feels like things are not under your control. And how can you change something? I mean, it's you know, the pandemic is terrible, right? The war in Ukraine is terrible. How can you change anything when there's all of these different factors? But on the other hand, if there's one factor, if there's one cause, and this is why I think people have wanted to latch on to that cause, right? If there's one cause, and in particular, if we can make that cause a group, or this is where maybe scapegoating comes in, if we make that cause a group or a group of people with intention, here's where we get into conspiracy theories, then there, it's easier to find a solution. All you have to do is just solve that, you know, eliminate that conspiracy, take care of that. I mean, so one conspiracy theory that's become somewhat prominent in the U.S. is QAnon. I'm not sure if you've heard of this.
Unfortunately, I have, yes.
Okay. Right. So, yeah. So if you can blame many or all the ills in the world on this single cabal of diabolical individuals running things, then that's a much easier solution than all of these little individual problems.
Yeah. And it's historically, it happens over and over
again. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, like in the 1930s, the era that I really focus on, you're looking at a lot of Irish Catholics were the cause of the depression in certain cities, right? And so we got to get rid of all these Irish Catholics. And you're like, come on, like, of course, like, it's ridiculous. Yeah. But it just happens repeatedly because it is effective for galvanizing people against something or galvanizing people towards some sort of political end. And so it just works over and over again. And it leads me to, I've taken more time than I said I would, and I apologize, but I'll get you out of here on this. As we continue with the 21st century, the continued proliferation of these sources of information, people try to navigate it. Congress in the United States is dipping its toe in regulating in some way, as is Parliament here in Canada, trying to understand how to do it. But ultimately, as it sits right now, it comes down to the individual to try to navigate these spaces as best they can. So from your experience and in your working with students towards this, what are some of the best pieces of advice or tips that you like to give to people on how they can best navigate these spaces and ensure that the information that they are getting is the best available?
Yeah, you know, I would say, one, make sure that we'll just talk about online sources. If you're looking at online sources, make sure that you are following it back and figuring out, ideally, if it's somebody, you can attach a name to it or an organization, figure out who that person is, what credentials, figure out that organization, what their purpose is. Having a bias doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, because again, everybody has a bias, every organization has a bias, right? But you just need to know what it is and be able to figure out how that might factor into what's being produced, or if it's especially pernicious or not. The other big thing I would say is making sure that you're reading laterally and triangulating. So we talk about this a lot in class. If you come across something and it's like, that's kind of odd, you might, you know, look, can you find it in at least two other sources that can confirm this? Okay. So looking at information coming out of Ukraine right now, I mean, I look at my Twitter feed and it is crazy. It is, you know, again, this hot mess, and it's, you know, I don't know, did this really happen? Did this not happen? Don't believe everything you see right off the bat. I mean, right now, misinformation and disinformation, right, is so rife that we really need to be making sure that we're corroborating everything by looking for multiple points of reference and from good sources that we can make sure that we know who's behind them, the purpose and the possible credentialing there.
Really good pieces of advice, really good tips for navigating all this. And as you say, it's not the easiest to do, but it's important that we all try our best to do it and get the best possible information. Another thing too, that if we are on social media seeking out and engaging with good information, that helps the algorithm a little bit, right? Because that's what rises to the top,
absolutely,
right? If we're using good information, that bots that are out there will try to engage with you so that they get more impressions. Don't do that. Like, it might feel good to like yell back at a bot, but don't do it. Right.
Don't
engage
it
with the
don't
good
stuff. Yeah, that's right. That's true. Yeah. That's gonna bump it up.
Yeah. It just pushes it up more. So try as much as possible, engage with the good stuff and beat the algorithms as best we can. So again, the book, Falsehood and Fallacy, How to Think, Read and Write in the 21st Century. Bethany, if people want to pick up a copy of the book, where would you encourage them to go? Or if they just want more information about you and some of your other work, how can they follow along?
Yeah, well, you can go to University of Toronto Press, right? They're the publisher. And just thanks to them for reaching out to me on this project and doing a really great job with it. Wonderful people to work with. Also, Amazon.com. You can pick up a copy there, other major bookstores as well. In terms of looking at other ways to find out about my work, just Google my name. My website at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, USA will pop up. And I'm on Twitter as well. There's another Bethany Kilcrease who lives in Mississippi. You'll probably be able to tell the difference. So.
All right. Well, she encourage everybody to. But you just don't know her. Yeah.
We're just different people.
Right. Right. It's there's the great kid. There's a guy, Aaron O'Toole in Canada, not the now former leader of the Conservative Party, Aaron O'Toole, but he had apparently a very fun 3 years on Twitter.
Yeah, I bet he did.
As that Aaron O'Toole. So yeah, hopefully the other Bethany Kilcrease doesn't do something crazy and just launch a lot of bad attention on the name.
Well, it seems like she just has the account but has never really done anything with it. So it's just sort of sitting there. And this other random kind of thing.
Again, we encourage everybody to check out the book, follow along on Twitter, and look up some of Bethany's other work. So Bethany Kilcrease, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there you have it, my chat with Bethany Kilcrease. And again, I thank her for her time. And do check out the book, Falsehood and Fallacy, How to Think, Read, and Write in the 21st Century. Very important material in there as we try to navigate the very crowded space of the internet. And there are, as we said, there's bad actors out there who are intentionally trying to put out bad information for very malicious purposes. So these sorts of things, they're just going to continue to increase in their prominence and their significance. And we have to be aware of that while at the same time being aware of some of the challenges associated with gatekeeping, as we talked about in the show. So complex issues here, no doubt about it. So hopefully you enjoyed that as much as I did. And thank you so much for listening, as that will do it for this week on the show. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever it is you get your podcast. Do the likes, ratings, comments, all that good stuff helps us grow the show, helps other people find what we're doing here on the History Slam. And of course, do head on over activehistory.ca. You can find all of our past episodes under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material, including a couple interviews and book reviews that have come out recently. So wonderful stuff over there on the website. So check it out. Of course, you can always let me know what you want to hear on the show, historyslam@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at @TheSeanGraham. So thanks again so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back to the weekly schedule through April. Took a couple weeks off here in March, but we're going back to the weeklies coming up with some really fun stuff for you, and I'm very excited to share it with you. So do follow along, and I appreciate all the support as we have grown the show over the past couple of years, and looking forward to continuing that through the spring. So hopefully you'll join me for it, but until we speak again, if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.